Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Laura Soul.
And it's been a long time since we've seen you, Laura. How have you been?
Yeah, good. I've had a lot of work to do, so that's been good for my PhD, I think. I had a big conference, so I had a lot to get done before that. But yeah,
what
so that's why I haven't been around. Evolution.
That's a very broad conference.
Well, I guess it's probably really... or originally was an evolutionary biology conference, but a few paleontologists go. I went last year as well, so maybe I spoke about it after I'd been last year, I can't remember. But yeah, so it's really good, because there's people who are kind of really interested in broad patterns that you can see in living and extinct groups. So there was a lot of stuff about understanding patterns in extinction and that kind of thing, which is what I'm interested in. So yeah, it was really good. Met lots of people from all over the place.
So where was it?
Raleigh. I'm not sure I'm supposed to pronounce it. In North Carolina, in the States.
Oh, right.
So, okay. Yeah, that was odd. It was interesting. I've never been
nice
to...
Nice trip.
I guess it's the South, isn't it? So yeah, it was fun.
And how's your PhD going?
Yeah, good, I think.
Nervous laugh.
Yeah, well, we've got... Have you told everyone we're going to IPC4?
We're going to IPC4, everyone.
Yay. But I'm presenting stuff at that. So I've got a bunch of stuff to get done over the summer for that, and I've done a bunch of stuff for evolution. And then hopefully by the end of IPC4 I'll kind of have most stuff together. And then I just have to write a thesis. Easy.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Well, I've got all that to look forward to because I've just secured myself a PhD at Bristol.
Yay!
I know, after however many years, it must be 5 or 6 years of wanting a PhD and starting it at 29, 30. It's a bit late, but...
Better
hey,
late than never.
Yeah, it's something I really want to do and I finally got one, doing exactly what I want to do. So I'm very, very happy. And so I've started moving from Manchester to Bristol, and that is why I'm just on this shoddy microphone in my laptop, because all of my nice microphones are packed up, so sorry about that.
So that's why you sound rubbish, not because you've been out celebrating.
That's why I sound rubbish. That's why you don't have my normal silky smooth voice. Otherwise, in the PaleoCast world, we've had our art competition going on using hashtag PaleoCastArt. And that's been going really, really well. We've had tons of submissions so far.
Yeah, so we've had loads of really cool stuff coming in. We've had lots of things already. Some of them are incredibly beautiful, but if you're not sure how great your artistic talent is, don't be put off. It's the content that's important and the likes that you get.
Yep, so a lot of these really, really good images are produced by professional paleo artists. And so they're ineligible, but they're still sharing, and that's something that I wanted anyway. So do not be put off. It's all like and favorite based. So as Laura said, it's the content. If you draw something like trilobite, something like anomala carotid, then you're going to get the likes for that. If you put the time and effort in, we'll appreciate it.
Yeah, have some invertebrates too. Got a lot of dinosaurs right now, I think.
Yeah. Oh, and now if you're using the hashtag PaleoCastArt on Facebook, we're having some issues with seeing these posts because of the privacy settings on everyone's accounts. So the best thing to do now, if you're going to upload on Facebook rather than Twitter, is to post it directly to our Facebook page, or just send us a message and we'll get it and share it. So, Laura, what's today's interview about?
So, I spoke to Alison Daly, she's at working at Oxford, like I am, except she has a proper job, about anomala carotids, which we just mentioned we'd like in the art contest. But yeah, so these are really cool, very odd Cambrian things.
Yeah, they're pretty famous from the Burgess Shale. I remember studying them about in university about how they were discovered.
Yeah, so I talked to her a bit about that, and she kind of goes into more detail of like the process of how they put this picture together of what these very odd looking animals were like and what they were doing and things. So yeah, it's pretty cool to hear about how that process works, where you find things that are really ambiguous because it's so long ago in the fossil record, and trying to figure out what was actually going on.
Yeah, they're a pretty strange animal. I guess it'd be pretty hard to describe them just using words. I don't think I'd like to give that a go.
But yeah.
We'll have plenty of pictures on the website.
Yeah, and Alison gives it a pretty good go. She sort of pieces together various bits of modern animals, and so you can kind of imagine what they might have been like.
Well, I've had nothing to do with this episode at all, so I'm really excited to hear what Alison has to say.
Alison Daly, who is at Oxford University. She's both lecturer in animal diversity in the zoology department and a research fellow at the University Museum of Natural History. Hi, Alison.
Hello.
So you've ended up in Oxford via Canada, which is where you're originally from. How did you become a paleontologist, and what have you studied in your course to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I guess I liked fossils as a kid, like most people do, but sort of just liked it for a while, and then got really interested in biology and particularly genetics. So I decided to go to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and was signed up to do a biology degree, but for one of my elective courses, took a geology course on the recommendation of my mum, who suggested geology is fun. So I took the course and really just absolutely loved geology and became so fascinated with sort of all the different concepts unifying information from biology, chemistry, physics, etc. So I switched from biology to do a double major in geology, which meant I kind of did the core curriculum of both biology and geology. And that was kind of the closest you could do to a paleo degree in Canada. You couldn't just take an undergrad in paleontology. So at the end of my degree, I looked for a master's degree at a master's program. I went to the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, and did a 2-year research project there and studied borings in brachiopod shells throughout the Ordovician, Silurian, and Devonian. And then thought I'd like to go to Europe for a bit. So I saw a PhD advertised at Uppsala University and applied and managed to get the position. So I was in Uppsala University for 4 years. Well, 4.5 years to do my PhD, and then just sort of carried on from there. I did a postdoc at the Natural History Museum in London, and then came here to Oxford.
Great. And what's your main research focus at the moment?
So at the moment, and for the last few years, I've been studying a group of fossil organisms called the anomalocaridids. And these are Cambrian fossils and some Ordovician examples as well, but mostly Cambrian fossils known from sites such as the Burgess Shale and Chenjiang Biota, and so on.
How did you end up studying specifically those as opposed to the things you'd done previously at brachiopods?
It was the first group of fossils that was written into the PhD project I applied for, which was quite wide-ranging and was also supposed to look at the evolution of chelicerates and insects and a lot of different things. But the first step was to do a restudy of some anomalocaridid fossils from the Burgess Shale. My co-supervisor was Jean-Bernard Caron at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, and through him I had access to the collections there. And it turned out that wasn't a small project. There was a lot of material there. I looked at thousands of fossils, and so it sort of grew from there, from being just one project to looking at a whole diversity of animals. And then I got interested in examples from other localities, other ages. So it sort of has just grown from that first project in my PhD.
So before we go any further, what is an anomalocaridid?
Sure. These are, as I said, they're Cambrian fossils largely, although they've been recently found in the Ordovician. They are soft-bodied fossils. So they're known from sites where you have really exceptional preservation. It's not just bones and shells, like hard bits, you also get soft parts as well. So they're large, soft-bodied animals. They're sitting on the stem lineage to arthropods, so they're related to the modern group of arthropods. And they're also thought to be predators in these environments. So they're sort of, originally they were thought to be apex predators because of their large size. So they're big, soft-bodied Cambrian fossils with a really interesting, unusual morphology.
Hey, what did they look like? Do they look a bit like anything we have in the modern day?
They look quite different, actually, from anything we have in the modern day. They had very wide, flat bodies. So if you could picture maybe a stingray, something like that, with wide bodies. But instead of having a smooth body, they had a segmented body. So a series of segments in their body with really wide flaps that they used to swim through the water. On their head, they had two very large appendages or limbs that had quite sharp spines and numerous spines and these two large appendages at the front of the head. They had also on their head a pair of eyes on stalks. So these were large eyes that had many, many lenses, so thousands of tiny little lenses to help them see. Also on the underside of their head, they had a strange mouth structure. So their mouth parts are circular and made of plates that sort of have an opening in the middle and lots of sharp spiny teeth facing into the mouth opening. And some of them have a large tail fan at the back of their body. Some of them have a more simple tail fan or no tail fan at all.
So you mentioned the Burgess Shale, mm-hmm. But also that they've been discovered in other places since they were first found in the Burgess. Where mm-hmm. else in the world have they found them?
So you get quite a few different taxa from the Chenjiang biota in China, which is largely in the Kunming region. You also get several from Australia. There's quite a big collection from there now. Also the Greenland Sirius Passet biota. And several smaller sites from places such as Poland, Siberia, several sites in the United States, Czech Republic, and so on. So it's actually quite a few now, Cambrian Lagerstätte, have at least some pieces of anomalocaridids, and they're almost everywhere. You get soft part preservation, you see the anomalocaridids.
So they're mostly Cambrian, which is about 500 mm-hmm. million years ago, but they've found some younger ones as well. Which sites have the younger ones in?
Right, so that's mainly from one site, from the lower Ordovician. This is called the Fezziwata biota, and it's in Morocco.
Okay. What are the differences? Do you get the same type of preservation in all those different places, or does it vary quite a lot?
In broad strokes, it's the same type of preservation in that it's soft part preservation. And for all the Cambrian sites, at least, they're sort of compressed fossils. So they are compressed down to just a few millimeters in thickness, and they're preserved as carbon-rich films on the surface of shale rock, so really fine-grained rock. And they're quite interesting preservation because in some of the sites, such as the Burgess Shale, although they're compressed, you see the relative positions of body parts still intact. So you can sort of chip away the outer head carapace and get down to the skin. You can chip away that layer and get down to maybe some internal features, and then you can chip your way through that. So you can almost dissect these fossils, but it is a destructive process, so we only do it when absolutely necessary.
So I can remember from my undergrad days being taught that when they originally found these things, they found the great appendages, which you've already mentioned, mm-hmm. these two things on the front of their heads, and then the mouthpiece, and they were kind of always separate, and they thought that they were different organisms. They were named as different species. And why were they always found in that mm-hmm. disarticulated way, and how did you eventually piece them together to the organism that we know now?
Yeah, so certain parts of their body, such as the mouth parts that I described and the frontal appendages, are a little bit harder than the rest of the body. So it seems like they were sort of cuticularized. They weren't mineralized, but they were maybe as hard as, say, fingernail, as opposed to the softness of, say, skin or something much softer. So those parts are what we find in great abundance. So the very first anomalocaridid fossil ever described was an anomalocaris, which was thought at that time to be the body of a shrimp that was missing a head, because these appendages are kind of long and thin, they're segmented, and they have a pair of spines, and people thought those spines were maybe legs. So it was thought, okay, that's the body of a shrimp. The head's missing, but oh, that's okay. And people tried piecing it on to other fossils that were kind of enigmatic from the Burgess Shale, but nothing really looked right. A few years later, they found this wide, round plate structure with the hole in the middle. And these we now know are the mouth parts, but they were thought then to be a jellyfish. So if you can picture sort of a pineapple ring floating through the water column, that's how people described or interpreted the life habit of these supposed jellyfish. Other parts, sort of half partial body specimens, were thought to be a sea cucumber or a cnidarian or a coral, various interpretations. But it wasn't until there were a lot of collections that had been sort of deposited in places like the Royal Ontario Museum and also the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. And people started getting a lot of material, and Harry Whittington and Derek Briggs in the 80s started doing this sort of dissecting that I described earlier, where they took a pin and they were chipping away some overlying tissue, and they discovered on a specimen that was, they weren't sure what it was, that it had these two anomalocaris appendages, these bodies of a shrimp. There were two of them attached to the head of something that had that patoia, that jellyfish structure, as the mouth part. So it was really through a lot of collecting and through people, really dedicated researchers, sitting down, dissecting things and piecing it all together. And so at that time, they were able to describe two taxa with slightly different frontal appendages. And since then, collecting efforts of the Royal Ontario Museum in the 70s, 80s, and 90s revealed that there's an even larger diversity of anomalocaridids. So part of my work described a third anomalocaridid that we know from having a whole body, and we have several other taxa that we know only from appendages. So we kind of live in hope that their bodies might one day be discovered, but we don't have them as of yet.
Okay, so it seems like quite a lot of the developments have been from digging things out of museums or actually going out into the field and finding things over the past kind of couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
You've been involved with the discovery process and gone on field work. What's that like?
The field work is absolutely amazing. So I've been really fortunate in that I've gone to both the Burgess Shale in the Rocky Mountains in Canada and the Emu Bay Shale in Australia. Very, very different environments. So the field work we did was really high in Canada, was really high up in the Rockies. It was August, but some days we still had snow. It involved a lot of hiking and camping, which fortunately I really enjoy. And then it's basically, some of the work we did was exploratory. So there are many sites of Cambrian rock outcrops throughout the Rockies. And Jean-Bernard Caron and his predecessor, Des Collins, both from the ROM, have done a lot of sort of mapping of these sites, and they go out in helicopter and they check a lot of different sites to see if it has soft part preservation. The field work that I did in 2008, we were largely at a site called the Stanley Glacier, and that was hiking up, and then it's really just sitting there splitting rocks for the better part of the day. So you get a piece of shale, get out your hammer, split it open, and just hope that you get something exciting in there. And, you know, these sites really deliver. You know, we're getting some absolutely incredible fossils being discovered. And that's sort of more remote, slightly harder going weather conditions for the Canadian sites. But in Australia, it's completely different. So we're able to drive right up to the quarry. It's obviously different climate, so it's much warmer. There are, you know, we have a view of the ocean. There are kangaroos hopping by. So it's incredibly pleasant. And a great crew of people just, you know, hammering rocks open all day, hoping to get some really great fossils.
So presumably because, you know, there's very flat carbon films, you can crack rocks open and not worry too much about damaging them.
Yes, exactly. So the fossils create a plane of weakness, and they tend to break along through the fossils. So they kind of help us with their discovery in that way.
So the Burgess Shale itself and these other sites that you've been talking about, what was the paleo environment for those? What kind of rocks do we see now, and what would it have been like back in the Cambrian?
Yep. So the rocks that we see now, they're largely preserved in shale rocks. So these are really fine grained, usually dark in color when they're fresh, which is probably a deep water environment. These are all marine fossils, of course. Most of the sites in terms of their paleolatitude were sort of equatorial or sub-equatorial, most of them anyway, would have been in quite sort of warm localities. And they were probably living in the shallow marine environment, these communities of animals, but they were transported down into deeper water environments where they were able to be preserved with such amazing detail.
So we've already talked about how they're often disarticulated. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that they're never really found in a life position. What's the explanation for how these things got to where they are and the circumstance of their exceptional preservation?
Well, so in the Burgess Shale, you can see that the main fossil sites are very close to a geological feature called the Cathedral Escarpment. So this is a large sort of scarp of rock that may indicate this sort of classic model that people are suggesting that they were sort of living near a submarine canyon and there was some sort of mass transport, a sort of underwater landslide, if you will, that transported them really suddenly and quickly from a shallow environment to a deep environment. A lot of these communities don't show huge indications of transport and wear and tear, so they couldn't have been transported very far. Though, of course, you do get disarticulation. There are some examples of trace fossils, but very few examples, so they weren't living in those exact environments. And in terms of the sort of method of preservation, it seems that there was elements of a very rapid burial involved so that they weren't degraded by sort of bacterial activity, and possibly also some very early mineralization that played a role in preserving these fossils as well.
And what else do you see there? What other life forms were around at the time?
So you see quite a wide variety of animals. A huge proportion of them are arthropods. So you do get sort of the classic trilobites living in these environments as well, but many soft-bodied arthropods that have various different sort of segments in their body, different appendages. Some look fairly similar to modern arthropods, some not so much. You also get animals such as that you would recognize, so you can see some brachiopods, some corals, these kind of things. But you also get quite enigmatic animals that are very different from what we have today. So there are these lopopodians, of which Hallucigenia is a very famous example. These kind of look like the modern velvet worm. They have soft bodies with annulations and really soft legs that they were walking around on. So you get kind of a mix of hugely enigmatic animals and somewhat familiar animals as well.
Do we have an idea about how they were all interacting in the ecosystem at all?
Yeah, there are some indications, and people have done sort of community level analyses by looking at the numbers, the relative abundance of different animal groups in specific beds. But in terms of direct interactions, it's not that kind of information. It's not usually preserved because there is a bit of transport going involved here. So,
in terms of how anomalocaridids fit into this picture, I know there's some hypotheses about how they fed, maybe what they ate, and that possibly they were predators, although it's a bit controversial. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So when they were first described as the whole body animals in the 80s, it was suggested that they were apex predators in these ecosystems. So particularly Anomalocaris, it's got these quite dexterous large appendages on the front of its head with sharp spines. It's got really robust teeth-like structures on its mouth parts, and it's quite a bit larger than the rest of the animal community. So they could be, you know, up to 60 or 70 centimeters in length, whereas the average Burgess Shale fossil is, you know, 2 or 3, maybe up to 5 centimeters. So really quite a bit bigger than everything else, with this armament of appendages and sharp teeth. So that's a pretty good suggestion that it was predating on something. And there were sort of models made of how they might swim around seeking out prey. There was also some suggestions that they were specifically eating trilobites at this time. And that was because there are specimens of trilobites found with bite marks in them, sort of big W-shaped or semicircular gouges out the side of their body. You also get coprolites, so fossil poo, with pieces of trilobites in them. So something was obviously eating trilobites. So it was suggested that Anomalocaris was kind of grabbing these trilobites and munching on them. More recent discoveries have shown that anomalocaridid ecology is not that simple picture of just eating trilobites and being a highly specialized predator, just eating trilobites. You see a wide diversity of morphologies of the appendages. So instead of these short, robust spines like Anomalocaris, you get ones with really long spines that have these sort of filtrating type devices on them. So they, some of them may have been crude sort of filtrating or sifting through sediment or the water column, almost like a net in the water column, which would be a more sort of generalized way of predating on the animals in the community. And in fact, there's a recent discovery of an animal called Temesiocaris from the Sirius Passet in Greenland, where Winter and his colleagues described a suspension feeding appendage that is thought to be an anomalocaridid. So this wouldn't even have been a predator. It would have been suspension feeding in the water column with very, very fine filtrating hairs on its appendages. So actually their ecology is really much wider than we had originally envisioned as these top super specialized predators. Actually, they're employing many different ways of finding prey and consuming prey.
You've mentioned quite a few different sort of species names, mm-hmm. And especially some that have been discovered recently. How diverse do we think they might have been, and how many different species or genera do we know about now?
I did a count recently, and if I'm remembering rightly, it was something like we have 14 different genera and 18 or 19 species. So actually it's quite a diverse group now. And I mentioned all the different sites before. You know, there's 4 or 5 genera from the Chenjiang biota, some of them known just from appendages, some with whole bodies. We have 5 or 6, I think, in total from the Burgess Shale now, several from the Emu Bay Shale as well. So they are quite diverse, and they are at the point now where they're quite well known. So we have several specimens of most of these species that we can get quite detailed descriptions out of, and get we're starting to be able to get a view of their sort of biodiversity on a global scale. And this is one of the projects I'm sort of working on at the moment, is making a detailed and highly inclusive phylogeny of the anomalocaridid group, including every known taxon that's been described to date. And much of that has been redescription of old material as well as description of new material as well. So we're getting a pretty clear picture of their diversity now.
Yeah. So they're morphologically or ecologically diverse in the sense that they seem to be feeding in different ways, and they have these different appendages on the front. What other differences do you see between each of these different species?
So we find differences in their mouth parts, which was fairly surprising, because it was thought that this 32-plate oral cone, as it was originally described, was fairly similar in every taxon that had been described. And then actually it turned out that some of them, instead of having 32 plates and 4 really large plates that were perpendicular to each other, some of them only have 3 large plates instead of 4, and varying numbers of plates in between. And they seem to have some more robust hard mouth parts, and some were softer and perhaps used for suction feeding as opposed to an actual potential biting mechanism. So we see diversity in the oral cones, which we didn't expect. And we don't have as many specimens preserving the bodies of these animals, but they tend to be largely quite similar. So they have a central body core, which has very prominent gill-like features on the body and wide swim flaps. You also see variation in the taxa between their tail fans. So I mentioned before, some have quite large tail fans, some have very small tail fans, or none at all. And also differences in their sort of the shielding of their head. They have, some of them have carapaces extending over their head or extending forward from their head, and you see different orientations in that as well.
So you've started to build a phylogeny, or an idea of the relationships between these species themselves. Do we know also how they fit into the bigger picture, the bigger tree of life, and in what way they're related to modern taxa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we seem to have a pretty good idea of that now, actually. So recent phylogenetic analyses are converging on a position of anomalous heritids in the stem lineage to the modern phylum Arthropoda. So today this includes insects, crustaceans such as lobsters and crayfish, spiders and others, chelicerates, and also the centipedes and millipedes. So this would be the what's referred to as the crown group, Arthropoda. This is all modern representatives of that group. But fossil specimens or fossil taxa that are quite similar to the arthropods but don't have every single arthropod character, so they can't go in the crown group, can sit in the stem lineage, which is just a sort of string of fossils that we can nicely place in this lineage leading up to the arthropods. And in broad strokes, we have a pretty good idea of how that lineage looked. So it started, basically you have the Lopopodians, which I briefly mentioned earlier. These are things that look like modern velvet worms or onychophorans. They have an annulated body and paired walking limbs. And so you have examples, Aishaya is a sort of a quite famous example, but you have ones from China that are slightly more arthropod-like in that they have frontal appendages and gut diverticulae. Moving up from there, you get taxa from the Sirius Passet biota in Greenland. These are referred to as gilled Lopopodians, and they have lopopod walking limbs, so soft walking limbs, but you also see swim flaps that are similar to the anomalocaridid swim flaps, and they have a more obvious head region with appendages. And then just up from these gilled Lopopodians is where you see the group of anomalocaridids. And this is the group I've been discussing. So you see the frontal appendages are jointed. They look very arthropod-like, so they have sort of segments that are a bit harder, and in between those segments you see membranes, just like you would in the jointed appendage of a modern arthropod. You see segmentation in their body as opposed to annulation, like the Lopopodians have. They actually have proper segmentation in their body. And then moving up from the anomalocaridids, you have a whole series of sort of upper stem arthropods, that things that really start to look like modern arthropods. So instead of swim flaps, they have biramous limbs, so these two-part limbs that have a walking branch and a sort of gill-like branch. And they have various, a very wide variety of morphologies and structures in their head. And these sort of sit in various debated positions, so there is some controversy in this lineage as well. And then moving up from there, we get into the crown group of the arthropods. So we kind of have a fairly decent story of how arthropods gain their characters in this stem lineage moving up through the different steps. And the anomalocaridids are in a very key position here, where you start to really see quite a few arthropod-like characteristics. So they've been quite useful for understanding features such as the evolution of cephalic shields in the arthropods. You see gut diverticulae and a tripartite gut, which is sort of the first time you get such a highly developed gut structure. It's also helped us understand the evolution of biramous limbs, which I described before. So they are quite sort of key taxa in understanding the evolution of the arthropods, which of course are today the most speciose and most diverse group alive today, in terms of abundance or diversity. An incredibly important group, both in the Cambrian and today.
It seems like the group at large went extinct over quite a long period of time. It was quite a gradual thing rather than them all disappearing in a mass extinction. Do we have an idea of why they disappeared?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting question, really. When we thought that they were just Cambrian animals, and they went extinct at the end of the Cambrian, just like many other enigmatic features. And this sort of preceded the Ordovician radiation, where we saw many more modern-looking animals evolving and sort of dominating the ocean environment. But these Ordovician anomalocaridids from Morocco, which is another project I'm currently working on with Peter Van Roy and Derek Briggs at Yale, are really interesting for that reason and for many other reasons. So we thought they went extinct in the Cambrian. Obviously they didn't. They survived into the Ordovician, at least the lower Ordovician. And they have quite significant changes. So these animals from the Ordovician are really huge. I mean, 2.5 meters in length. They're absolutely enormous. And they have some other differences in their morphology, but we could still identify them as anomalocaridids. Without doubt, that's what they are. So they clearly just didn't go extinct suddenly at the end of the Cambrian. They existed into the Ordovician and were probably coexisting with other predators that would have been of a fairly large size in these environments. So potentially competition with newly evolving animals in the Ordovician radiation may have eventually led to their I guess, overall extinction event.
So what are the main questions that you have left to answer or that you're working on at the moment?
Well, I mentioned that I'm working with my colleague Greg Edgecombe at the Natural History Museum on doing a really detailed phylogeny of the anomalocaridids, trying to understand their interrelationships and also sort of their placement in the stem lineage. I'm also hoping to extend that work to look at sort of biogeographical implications, you know, how they evolved into the sort of communities that we see at the moment. I'm also collaborating with people here at Oxford with some projects we're starting up looking at the ecology of the anomalocaridids and sort of the evolution of their specialist or generalist predation mechanisms in terms of how they're getting prey. And we're doing some mathematical ecological modeling in that respect. And we'd like to extend that to look at the Cambrian explosion in general, so sort of modeling ecological interactions in the Cambrian and comparing it to the modern to see if Cambrian ecologies were sort of similar to modern day or if they were different in any fundamentally different ways. In addition, I have sort of ongoing work to look at old collections and new collections of material. So next week, I'm off to Poland to look at the Polish anomalocaridid material and potentially work on Chinese material, Emu Beishe material from Australia, and you know, various old and new sites as well. So there's a lot going on.
How much of it is, or how much more can you find out from re-examining or examining material that's in museums, and how much is kind of just hoping for that amazing fossil in a new place that will tell you a bunch of new stuff?
I guess you can always live in hope of the perfect specimen just appearing in the rock. And we kind of make jokes about that before starting a field season, like, oh, make sure you find that complete anomalocaris or whatever. But the material that's already being collected is really incredible, actually, for this group. And some of it that was studied a few decades ago, we since have developed or we've been able to employ new imaging techniques and analysis techniques so we can photograph them in different ways or look at them under the SEM so that we can get more information out of old specimens. And that's also a process of discovery that's just as exciting as going in the field and finding new specimens. So there's so much work we can do on museum collections, you know, even really old ones. So it's kind of a bit of both, I suppose. Of course, we should keep going out in the field and trying to find new material, but it's just as exciting to use new techniques on old specimens as well.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed that interview. I think there's going to be some real big things coming out of anomalocaridid research in recent years. And it really surprised me just the diversity of this group, because I knew of Anomalocaris, but then the newer forms like the filter feeding one, it's just great to see that they've got so much diversity and there's so much more to them than I ever really thought
of. Yeah, I guess it's all very recent discoveries, so probably when we were doing our undergrad they only told us about Anomalocaris.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really cool because there's loads of things now and that they've managed to kind of piece them together into a sort of phylogeny and get an idea of the relationships between them. And I just think it's really cool because it's so long ago, but you can still figure these things out.
Yeah, I didn't know that you could basically dissect them, she was saying. That
yeah.
Even though they're splattered, completely flat, you can still understand the positioning
yeah,
of
I think,
elements of the body.
One of the photos that you should be able to see on the site is like a picture of kind of what it looks like when you've scraped off one of the layers and you can see the other layer underneath.
Did you ever see the in the UK we've got the newspaper The Daily Mail and they reported on the finding of the filter feeding anomala carotid. Did you ever see that one?
No, I didn't see the Daily Mail coverage. What did it say?
Well, we're going to have to put a link to it.
Okay.
On the website. They somehow they managed to think that because this anomala carotid was filter feeding, that it was the direct ancestor to whales.
Oh, yeah, no, I do remember that. It was an ancestor of whales because whales filter feed too. Yeah, but it's an arthropod, so that's a bit unlikely.
Hey, it might have happened, but...
It might have. But if it has, then I think our entire understanding of evolutionary relationships and how they work is a bit off.
Yeah, probably.
Hopefully that's not the case.
Hopefully not. We'll see what you think.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.